This is DJ Sweetie with In the Meantime on Enemy Combatant Radio. And it is Tuesday, June 21st. It's summer solstice. Happy summer solstice, everyone, 2005. On the show today on In the Meantime, we have John Abrams from SomoCo. That's the South Mountain Company based out of Martha's Vineyard, Massachusetts. Actually, very much rooted in Martha's Vineyard. And John Abrams just wrote a new book published in 2005 by Chelsea Green. And the book is called The Company We Keep, Reinventing Small Business for People, Community, and Place. And we've got John on the phone today calling in from Martha's Vineyard. And again, you are listening to enemycombatantradio.net. You can check out In the Meantime on there, enemycombatantradio.net/meantime. And this is a show where we talk about co-ops and collectives, and we're focusing on groups that are engaged in the economy and making change within the economy. So welcome to the show, John. Are you there?
I'm here, Mark.
All right. Thanks
a
lot.
How are you?
I'm doing really good. How are you?
Doing great.
Okay, good. So here, I'm going to pull out this music here. So tell us a little bit, what inspired you to write this book?
Well, there were two parts to that. One was the book had been welling up for a while, and I had been thinking about, since my daughter entered high school, taking a sabbatical from work when she finished high school to write this book. But the other part of it was to let this company that had been employee-owned at the time for 15 years get out from under me a little bit and see what happened if I took off. And so I took two winters off to write the book. And the book got written, and things happened at South Mountain Company.
Okay. Tell us, first of all, then what is South Mountain Company, and how did you get interested in design, and like what year did you start the company?
Well, South Mountain's a design-build firm. We work in one way and one way only. We do the planning, the architecture, the building, the interiors, whole thing start to finish. And we do high-end residential work, and we mix it with lots of affordable housing. So we do kind of the two ends of the spectrum. And we've been at it for 30 years in this same place. You asked how I got started. I got started, you know, I was a wandering hippie in the late 60s and trying to find shelter and put something over our head. And shelter became a passion. Mm. I got very interested in buildings and how they work, and so it was really by the seat of my pants.
Okay. Tell us a little bit about Martha's Vineyard and what, did you grow up there or what brought you there?
No, I grew up in San Francisco.
Oh, okay.
I came east to go to school, which never worked out that well. And we came in 1974 to the vineyard to do a house and had no intention of staying. And while we were doing this house, somebody else asked us to do another. My son was 5 years old. It was time for him to go to school, and we've been here ever since. So it was quite by accident.
Mm-hmm. So how about your family background? Were you did you come from a line of designers and builders?
No, none of that in my family. I came from an academic background. My father was a doctor in the Bay Area. And, this came, I had no clue that this is what I would do. So it was just how it happened.
Okay. You, in your book, you write about your grandfather, and you mentioned that he had a family business, and that, I guess the business eventually closed or kind of got, bits and pieces got sold off. And you say at some point that in some ways that influenced how you saw businesses being run in general. Is that right?
Well, it was a wonderful business. When I was a kid, we used to go to New York where all of my folks' family were. My grandfather had a hardware business down on Hudson Street, way downtown New York City, which grew to be quite a business. And over time, I used to go and spend a day there every time we would go to New York and fill up a toolbox with tools and take them back to California and lose them. Go back again another, 2 years later. But what I saw happen as I grew up is this business that was very familial, lots of old friends involved. But over time, many of the people left to start new businesses of their own, and my grandfather never, and his partner never provided for, like, what kind of succession would there be? How would they keep these people? How would they keep them engaged over the long term? So people left, and they took with them very valuable customers. And then I watched in my 20s as the business gradually faded, and many of the people who had been there for years and decades in some cases lost their jobs. And I saw that what happens when a business becomes a community like his business was and then doesn't sustain itself, doesn't plan for succession, is that a community is broken, a community is dismantled, and it was a very sad thing to watch.
Mm-hmm. Tell us how your business got started. Was that a family thing as well, or kind of a community thing?
It was a friend of mine and I, and we gradually hired people. It was very familial, but not actual family, although my partner and my wife were both involved early on, and it was a group of people that worked beautifully together. We had a lot of fun together, but when it had matured a bit, two of the people that had of our earliest employees came to me one time. Actually, my partner went on to other things, and so it was a sole proprietorship. There were maybe 10 employees. And two of the longest, the employees who've been around for 8-10 years, came to me and said, you know, this is what we want to do. This is where we want to be. This is where we want to make our careers. But we have to have, there's got to be something in it more than an hourly wage. We need a stake. So at that point, we started thinking about what would make sense and how to engage them in a way that they could stay on. And we happened on the notion of an employee-owned cooperative. We came upon the Mondragon model from the Basque country in Spain and actually did a restructuring where I sold the company to myself and these two guys with a structure that provided for anybody that worked there for a period of time becoming a full owner with a full stake, full control. And so we've evolved into an employee-owned cooperative corporation.
Mm-hmm. Do you think, it seems like you must have had a pretty good relationship with at least these two guys. Excuse me.
It was okay.
Okay. But they would feel comfortable enough to ask you to give them a greater stake in the company. Is that what they were looking for? Was a worker kind of owned co-op, or were they expecting a little bit less?
They didn't have a clue. They just knew they wanted something that would keep them there. They were very close friends. The three of us were close friends, and they were groping in the dark, and we all were looking for. I mean, what happened was it would have been very easy to make them partners and leave it at that. But when we started to think about it, we thought, well, this is going to come up over and over again. Hmm. And perhaps there's a structure that would allow for bringing people in, engaging people fully over time. So that's where the idea of the worker cooperative came from.
Mm-hmm. Had you, you said you kind of stumbled upon the Mondragon model. Or had you heard about that stuff before, or had that been happening around you at all?
No, not at all. We actually hired an attorney at the Industrial Cooperatives Association in Cambridge, Mass., which is an organization which has devoted itself for many years to the formation of employee-owned companies. And Peter Pitigoff, the attorney there, suggested this model. He said that this seems like it may work for you, and introduced us to it, and we made our own particular changes to that model, and it seemed to fit the bill.
Mm-hmm. So the role of friendship that had already been established, that played a strong part in forming a worker co-op.
Well, it absolutely did. And for me, it was, you know, this was a company that I had invested in so many ways for so long, and it was a bit scary to let go, but the people were people that I cared about a lot. But I think more importantly, the idea of how could we sustain this this sense of family, this sense of community, which at that point was only a sense because I had all the power and I had all the control. Mm.
You mentioned that in your book, that there's a sense of ownership versus something like having a sense of the meal at the dinner table.
Well, that's Corey Rosen, who is the executive director of the National Center for Employee Ownership, says, you know, having a sense of ownership is like a sense of dinner. And this is the whole meal.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So tell us a little bit about the structure then. You went from a sole proprietorship, which means single owner, and you basically became a employee-owned with three owners, and the rest were regular employees?
The rest were regular employees on a track toward ownership.
Uh-huh.
All of those people that... they're still here, our owners. There are now 16 owners and 30 employees, and all of those 14 are on a track toward ownership.
Okay. What's the difference between being a regular employee and someone who's on the track to ownership?
They all are. All employees are.
Oh, okay.
And in fact, it's really become the way we hire people. We don't hire people for a skill set. We hire people thinking about them as future owners. So our expectation, our intention is that anybody that comes to work at this company, we hope they'll stay, and we hope they'll become an owner.
Mm-hmm. And how long does it take them to become owners, or what's the path?
5 years.
5 years.
You work there for 5 years, and if you're still around, you are very likely to be an owner. You will be an owner if you want to pay the money that it takes and accept the responsibility that comes with it.
Mm-hmm. Is it a significant amount of money, or is it something that they can just kind of pay as they go, or how does that work?
Well, when it started, our notion was that it's important that it be real money, but not necessarily commensurate with return. More importantly, that it would be something that people could afford. Mm-hmm. so that they would do it. And we came up with the idea that it really should be roughly the cost of buying a good used car, because everybody, if you need a good used car, you're going to come up with the money. So at the time, it was $3,000 at the beginning.
Mm. That's not a whole lot of money, really.
Not a whole lot of money. And it's not a whole lot of money now. It's now, I think, $12,000. Mm. Still the price of a good used car, and your return the first year may be that or significantly more. So it's become a very good investment.
Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit, just give a little breakdown of the kind of the structure of the company. You have a different kind of office structure versus the folks who are out in the field, or how does that work?
So there are 30 people, and four of those are office management, half a dozen in design, four in a woodworking shop, two, three in the interiors department, the rest out in the field. So there's quite a, there are many different jobs. And the company really is managed by a group of committees. The board, which is the owners, mm-hmm. meets once a month and sets all policy. There's a management committee of four that manages day-to-day operations. And that actually came from my sabbatical from work. I mean, I managed the company for many years. When I left, we set up a management committee, which I'm now a part of. There's a design group. There's a production group. And there's a woodworking shop. So.
And do people pretty much find their groove and stick with it, or are people changing jobs?
Mostly, you know, people move around a little bit. People like to move around, but mostly people have a particular expertise and stick with it.
Mm-hmm. You know, I was watching this film. I'm not sure if you've seen it. It's called The Take by Naomi Klein and Avi Lewis. It's about,
I'm familiar with her, but I haven't seen the movie.
Okay. It's about workers in Argentina when the economy fell apart. They actually took over some factories that they had originally worked in and claimed ownership of them, essentially, and tried to manage them themselves.
I'm familiar with the story, yep.
Yeah. One of the things that struck me when they're doing an interview with a group that had just taken over one of the companies, they seemed a little bit idealistic in a lot of ways, and of course they were doing a real struggle. So you know, they're on the ground with it. But one of the things they said was that everyone was going to get paid exactly the same. And I wonder how many people experiment with that model and actually find that that works, or what would be the pros and cons of some sort of a model like that.
It's a tough one. I know one company, and it's actually a company, the building company in Boston that has been around for, I would say, 25 or 30 years, where everybody's paid the same. And the people that the people that are longtime owners of that company, today, if somebody comes into that company, they get paid the same.
Hmm. Is there some other kind of compensation for having initially risked or been stayed with the company so long?
I believe there is some equity that the longtime owners gain, but that is so unusual. Mm-hmm. And as far as I know, I mean, the Mondragon cooperatives are a good example. They started off with a 3-to-1 ratio between top earner and lowest earner, and they have not even been able to maintain that today. I'm guessing it's 12-to-1. In our company, it's about 4-to-1. Mm-hmm. And one of the things we've always done to mitigate, in part, the hierarchical wage scale that we have and that we believe in, it's based on expertise, it's based on longevity, is we do profit sharing that's based entirely on hours worked. So it doesn't matter how much money you make, if you work a particular number of hours that's the same as a higher wage earner, you're going to share the same amount of the profits. Mm-hmm. And then we have a second level of profit sharing that is the equity in the company that only goes to the owners. But once again, it's distributed on the basis of hours worked. So we have a typical hierarchical wage scale that's based on expertise and longevity, and then we partially mitigate it with these profit sharing mechanisms.
Wow, that's really interesting.
It seems to work, you know. It seems to, and it seems to make a lot of sense to people. And this is there's very much a culture of expertise here. Remember that this was a company that didn't start employee owned, and I think that's there's a lot to talk about there. It may be that it makes sense for companies to be individually owned or a partnership and get over the entrepreneurial hurdles that way, mm-hmm. and then make a move to employee ownership when the company has some maturity. Because one of the things that happens that I notice in our company is that there aren't a lot of power struggles. People believe that decisions ought to be made by those who have the expertise to make them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Where do new ideas come from in your company? Are you all? Do you kind of sit down every month and hash things out, or change the direction of stuff, or is it kind of the day-to-day work?
Both ways, because we do sit down as a group of owners once a month. We do sit down as a company a few times a year, but the various working groups is really where new ideas come from. So the design group sits down every week, the production group every 2 weeks. It's hard to say, you know, new ideas are popping up all the time, and there's definitely a sense that if you've got an idea, you'll find an ear.
Mm-hmm. So a lot of that, you said that the company is essentially managed by committees. Are those committees kind of appointed by someone, or do you elect people towards those roles?
The committees are, well, in fact, they're appointed by the owners, by the board, but it's less formal than that. The people that it's job related. So the people that design are the design committee. The people who do the office work meet as that office group. I don't know if that's clear, but
yeah, it makes sense. So would you say that then there really is kind of a blurry line between management and somebody who's more of a line worker, or somebody who doesn't have that kind of decision-making role?
No. I would say that there aren't blurry lines. It's very clear who has the decision-making role. So, for example, we have building jobs, and there's a foreman on each job. There's a crew on that job. The foreman makes the decisions. But it's highly collaborative. Each project has a project manager in the design group. That person makes the decisions. But I think the fact that there are constant gatherings, constant committee meetings, if anything, it doesn't blur the lines, but it gives a tremendous amount of support to those people whose job it is to make the decisions.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell us something about the demographics of Martha's Vineyard, where you are located. You say in your new book you're very rude.
Wild place. It's a place that is perceived to be a playground of the wealthy. It certainly is that, but it's so much more. Community of 15,000 people. There's an Indian tribe, 3,000 Brazilians, a town that is largely black, many, many working class people, and a tremendous number of people that that enjoy this place seasonally. So it's quite a mix. Mm-hmm. And it's a very interesting community. The there's a strong sense of community in many of the people that come here to enjoy it. It's the people here that they come for as much as the scenery and the beauty. And it's a place where people are pretty much left to their own devices. I mean, the early summer community, it was academics and artists and writers and, you know, gay. There was quite a gay community in the 40s and 50s. So it's always been a community of eccentrics, and those who come to the vacation here there's a lot of exchange between the people that live here and those that come to vacation.
Mm-hmm. And do most of your employees, or do all of your employees, are they drawn from the local community, or do people come from far
although,
away?
Although very few of them were born here. Mm-hmm. They're people that have come here over time. But most people in our company have lived here for 10, 20, 30, 40 years.
Mm-hmm. And how do you find new people for your company, or what motivates you to get new people? Are you growing all the time?
No, we're not. By and large, we have committed to not growing, and occasionally we grow for a particular reason. But when we do, it's very conscious. The people that we hire over the last 10 years, I would say, we've come to believe that it's important to hire people as future owners. So we're not hiring people for a skill set. We're looking at people and saying, are these people going to be around? Are there people that we would want to share ownership with? What are they going to bring in that sense? So when we do hire, we're really hiring future owners. And when we grow, we're growing for a particular purpose, with the sense that the bigger we get, the harder it is to keep the familiarity, to know everybody, to keep the continuity. So it's a tension all the time. Do we grow? And usually when we grow, it's because we think, okay, I mean, the opportunity is always there to grow. But the reason to grow is generally because of something we may be able to accomplish by the growth.
Mm-hmm. So basically, not growth for growth's sake. You mentioned Edward Abbey in there somewhere in your book.
Yeah, the notion of growing, constant growth being the idea of the cancer cell. No, our sense is that growth should be very conscious, very deliberate, and always with a sense of the consequences of growth.
And what do you think the consequences of growth are? You mentioned maybe a lack of familiarity amongst the people in the company. Is that pretty much it, or how do you see that? What do you see the drawbacks to growth being?
Well, I think one of the key things in our business is our sense that quality is the most important thing. And craftsmanship, relationships, everything that we do, having the time to do them well, having enough space to do the job that we want to do. And growth it's a lot of fun, it's thrilling, but often it takes away that space to do things as well as you really want to do them. So we always think of growth as something that it's going to cause new stresses, and they may be valuable, but there's no intrinsic need to grow as a company in the business that we're in. The internal growth, doing what we do better, that kind of growth, we welcome it all the time, but not necessarily just to get to be a bigger company. what's that really going to get us? And what I have found, and it's incredibly interesting to me, is that many of the people in our company, when faced with the issue of growth, which means more money for them, a share of greater profits, often say, that's not what I'm after here at work. What I'm after here at work is coming to a place that I love, working with people that I care about, doing a great job. The money is secondary. So the reasons for growth aren't always clear.
Mm-hmm. It seems like that goes pretty counter to a lot of people's thinking in our larger economy, that growth is imperative, that you need to kind of grow to keep from being crushed in the kind of rest of the competitive market. Do you feel there's something special about the design kind of build work you do, or would you say that might apply actually to other industries in the economy?
Well, yeah, not at all. I think that whatever you do, if you make bagels and you want to make the best bagels in the world, you don't have to make all the bagels in the world. And my sense is that we've got a very bizarre sense about growth that, and in fact, the perception is that a small company is just a company that hasn't done well enough to get large. So,
right, that's a
common... I'm not convinced that the idea of growth is needs to be a driving force in business. One of the things that's possible these days is rather than a business growing, I mean, one of the reasons, and I think a very valuable reason, if you're doing something and you're doing it well, you want to spread that widely, you want to spread that influence, but one way to do that is by sharing information instead of swallowing up the market.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's get to that in just a couple minutes here. I think we're going to take a little break. This is DJ Sweetie on Enemy Combatant Radio with the program In the Meantime, where we talk about co-ops and collectives. And I'm actually speaking with John Abrams, calling in from Martha's Vineyard, Massachusetts. He just wrote the book, The Company We Keep, Reinventing Small Business for People, Community, and Place. And let's take a little break here, John, give you a chance to drink some water, and we will do a little music and come back in just a couple of minutes.